You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges. And follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Now, next year, 2017, is going to be an important year for the European Union, for the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, and actually also for EU-ASEAN relations. We all here know that the European Union is going to turn 60 next year, and we know the challenges we face. ASEAN is going to turn 50. And what it is today, what ASEAN is today, the organization and the region, is very different from what it was 5 decades ago. We've got the ASEAN Economic Community. I'm not sure we've got it yet, but we're on the way to having an ASEAN Economic Community. And there's also, of course, Vision 2025. And the EU-ASEAN relationship is turning 40 next year. And that relationship, as all of you here know, has also grown over the last few years. We have now talk, I'd say coming back to the initial idea of some years ago, of having an EU-ASEAN region-to-region free trade agreement. And there's also hope that there will be a strategic partnership between the EU and ASEAN. But these are works in progress, if you like, and we'll be talking about them. But in this world, is a very unexpected place, unpredictable at the moment, and there are two elements that have arrived that will also impact on the European Union and on ASEAN and on EU-ASEAN. That, of course, is Brexit. That's one. And, of course, last week's election of Donald Trump as the US president. Now, this conversation today is not really about those issues. It's about ASEAN and the economic dynamism and vibrancy of ASEAN, and especially how European business, which is at the core of this relationship, the relationship is really about economics, trade, and investments between the two regions. And this conversation is about what European business, investors, exporters, financial services, what they think of ASEAN. How engaged are they with ASEAN? I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to pass the floor to Donald Kanak, chairman of the EU-ASEAN Business Council and also chairman of Eastspring Investments. I'm going to give you the floor for a few minutes, Donald, so you can introduce the ASEAN EU Business Council and also tell us a little bit about the sentiment, business sentiment survey that you've done this year. Please, floor is yours.
Thank you, Sharda. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for attending today. And special thanks to Friends of Europe for co-organizing this or pulling this together and allowing us to share some observations from folks who are on the front line, so to speak, in ASEAN. A few months ago, knowing that you mentioned Brexit, the U.S. election was on the agenda, many other pressing issues and main discussion themes, which were the focus in Brussels, that we thought maybe this year was not a good year to make a visit, to bring a delegation, as we had done in the previous year, to Brussels. But when we polled Friends of Europe, ambassadors in the region, people involved in economic and trading relationships between the region here in Brussels, between the regions, we heard a very resounding, no, you must come, because ASEAN could be the bright spot in what otherwise is a sort of troubled situation where many other issues are at least offering uncertainty, if not very, very big challenges. So we decided to come, and we've been here the past 2 days having meetings, friends from ASEAN, people engaged in the trade and economic relationship in the Commission and others. The EU-ASEAN Business Council is composed of the European Chambers of Commerce. There are at least 11,000 European companies we know in the ASEAN region. There are many more. We don't have an accurate total across all of the 10 ASEAN nations, but many thousands of companies represented by the Chambers of Commerce, and also a number of European multinational companies, which span manufacturing, services, financial services and information services as well, logistics, natural resources, and beyond. fast-moving consumer goods, et cetera. And they're not companies that are newcomers. The group that I'm affiliated with, Prudential, of which eSpring is the asset management organization for Asia, is over 90 years in ASEAN. One of our panelists, Gunter Taus, who you will hear from shortly, his company has been there for 198 years in Asia. So these are, you know, many, many companies with deep roots in the region, great expertise in the region, and deep commitment to the long-term sustainable growth and economic development. Sharda mentioned some important round numbers, 40, 50, 60. It seems 2017 is the year of anniversaries. We have some other round numbers that we share sometimes in talking about ASEAN, just to make it, to leave you with an easy to remember thought. And I'll leave you with 80, 90, and 100. So 80, and then between now and 2030, there will be another 80 million middle-class households, an increase, essentially a doubling of middle-class households in ASEAN. There'll be another 90 million people moving to cities in ASEAN. And between 2010 and 2050, there'll be more than 100 million increase in working population in ASEAN. Now, that is reason for optimism. Sharda mentioned the business sentiment survey, which recently was released in September across the region of European businesses. There are copies over there. I think you will, if you look at it, you'll see some very encouraging signs, very, very optimistic attitude about the region economically and about the prospects for European business in meeting the needs of those big numbers that I just discussed. But it also presents challenges, the challenges of urbanizing 90 million new urban residents, of finding jobs and opportunities for 100 million increasing working population, of social inclusion, and that the challenges that presents for an economic development that is generally sharing prosperity across the region. And so that is, in a sense, I think something that European companies have a lot to offer in the region. It's growth that can be sustainable, inclusive, and lead to a better, of course, for economic development in the region. And that's the spirit in which I think you'll hear our panelists talking today. So I thank you all very much for attending, and thank you, Sharda, for giving this opportunity to share.
Thank you very much indeed, Donald. So I'm Sharda Islam. I work at Friends of Europe, and it's my pleasure, and I have a host voice, it's my pleasure to introduce our panelists. First of all, Carsten Hess, he's Vice President and Head of Corporate Public Policy for the Asia-Pacific, Eastern Europe, Middle East, and Africa at Deutsche Post DHL Group. Thank you very much for coming here, Carsten. Excuse me. Alessia Mosca is member of the European Parliament Committee on International Trade. Thank you very much as well. Jose Antonio Buencamino, Special Trade Representative, Commercial Counselor at the Mission of the Philippines. And Peter Burtz, Head of Unit DG Trade for Southeast Asia, and DG Trade. And last but not least, introduced already by Donald, Gunter Taus, President of the European Chamber of Commerce of the Philippines and Managing Director for JEC Philippines. So a number of very upbeat and optimistic assessments from Donald, but the business sentiment also points to two things. One, that the business community needs to engage more with governments, both European governments and ASEAN governments, and that the business community is really optimistic about the AEC, but sees also, as Donald said, many challenges ahead. So let's kick off with you, Carsten. Has the establishment of the AEC, it hasn't really been established, but the news of the establishment, the beginning of the process, the work in progress, already had an impact on how you see the region, your business models, your plans, your priorities?
Yes, thank you, Sharda, and thanks for the invitation here. I think the AEC is reality almost for 1 year, but of course it hasn't delivered really a lot of tangible results for industry. But we, as with the DHL Group, we are in the region for 43 years now, and actually we are the ones who are moving the goods, the physical goods, across border for European companies, but also for non-European companies, and that means international trade lanes, but also within the 10 ASEAN member states. So what we see right now is that the time is ripe for ASEAN really to move to action. There are huge opportunities in the region. Let me just explain it on four examples. I think it's on. We see an increase of manufacturing in the region. So China will still do a lot of manufacturing, but because of the high wages, new factories are moving directly into ASEAN. Secondly, what we call, we are in the kind of age of networked industries. So you have components of one final product manufactured in several ASEAN countries. It's not just that you build a car in one country. So that means a lot of cross-border movement of spare parts is necessary. So a lot of trade can be created and can grow. Then you have the emergence of the micro and small medium-sized enterprises, MSMEs. So everybody who has a small company can become a global trader today by going online. So that will foster a lot of cross-border trade as well. And a small retailer can become a global company with the help of the internet. And linked to that, you will see, you mentioned or Don mentioned the growth of the middle class. You will experience that this middle class is very tech-savvy. They're shopping with their smartphones. So you will have a massive growth in the next years on e-commerce shipments cross-border. So with all these potential, these opportunities, I think what AEC can deliver is sort of implementing low-hanging fruits, putting in trade facilitation measures, reform customs laws, and you see some first movers like Vietnam, who has also signed an FTA with the EU, where they had a huge customs law reform last year, where foreign direct investment is pouring into the country. So AEC can actually deliver or help to deliver this to also the other member states of the ASEAN community. And I think that's, as an introduction, where we see a lot of potential from our company side.
One thing, Carsten, also that the Business Sentiment Survey talks about is how much European business wants an EU-ASEAN FTA.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is not a new idea. I mean, this has been out there for many, many years. I think almost 10 years originally the idea. I think maybe you can...
Another anniversary.
Yeah, probably another one, yeah. So I think at the end, to make sure that we don't end up with many, many FTAs, even though I think as a first step they're good, they're setting the scene. But of course, if you look, we have like 10 different standards when it comes to cross-border of customs, of trucks, of, you know, their technical standards. So of course, the ultimate goal would be to have a region-to-region deal, which would help seamless transportation of European cargo or within the ASEAN.
Right. Let's turn to Jose Antonio. Jose Antonio, the Philippines is going to be chair of ASEAN next year. What do you see, what have you established as the priorities for the regional grouping during your chairmanship? And is an EU-ASEAN FTA part of that? Please.
Very yeah. much so. The EU is going to be part of the of the ASEAN agenda in 2017 as a very special dialogue partner. Let me just read from my small notes.
Please.
On, hold on, there you go. The priorities for 2017. By the way, the slogan for ASEAN 2017 is partnering for change, engaging the world. So if I may just say a very personal message about that, whatever you hear, in the media about the leadership in the Philippines, I think this is what will hold for next year. We will partner with everyone, all of our partners in ASEAN, our dialogue partners, for change, and we will engage the world. We will not retreat from the world. Okay. Now, there are six themes for ASEAN 2017. Three of them are political and security oriented. I'm no expert in those areas. Two of them are social, people centered. But what I would like to just concentrate on is the economic pillar, which is the ASEAN economic community. And here, the theme is inclusive and innovation led growth. So what Carsten said is very much related to what I will also say. The emphasis of the Philippines will be on micro, small, and medium enterprises because these are the real drivers of inclusive growth. And I was in a small forum last week in the parliament, and some of the speakers were talking about legitimizing trade policy. One of the ways of legitimizing it is going down to the level of the micro, small, and medium enterprises. Now, the Philippines looks at the MSMEs as having a great potential for globalization, especially with the aid of technology. Now, aside from the substantive thrust of the Philippines next year, we also would like to go into measuring progress in the AEC. We would like to see more development of the index monitoring, like on trade facilitation. We'd like to see a trade facilitation index being developed so that we can monitor progress in this area. And the other one is, self-assessment and peer reviews. Now, this is not new anymore. This has been in practice in another organization called the APEC, but we would like it to be stronger in ASEAN.
Okay. Lisa, let me turn to you. So we're talking about an EU-ASEAN FTA. It's been, you know, on and off the rails for 10 years. But regional trade agreements, multilateral trade, doesn't really have a very good name at the moment, right? We've just seen the drama over the Canadian deal. TPP is probably in trouble. TIPP is probably in trouble as well. So is there any value in pursuing this free trade route that we were talking about today?
Yeah, thank you very much. First of all, let me stress the fact that not only the business community, but also the institutional community would like to have a region-to-region free trade agreement with the ASEAN region. So this is the ideal perspective, but perhaps the Commission will underline this as well. But we are in a moment in which we have to be in the real world, and for this reason, I think that the strategy that has been followed by the Commission in the last years to start from having some FTAs with some of the countries goes exactly in this direction. And I think that the two FTAs that have been already concluded with Vietnam and with Singapore are very, very good agreements, and especially the one with Vietnam is a very good agreement to get that could sign the model to have an enlarged and a region-to-region FTA, or at least start to have the first piece of a puzzle having in the club of the countries, the ASEAN countries, having an FTA with the EU, including other region, other countries, such as Indonesia. You know that the talks with Indonesia just started with great enthusiasm, and we really are eager to see the conclusion of this other agreement also with the Philippines that could start this process. And I also think that this process could also help to foster the process of creating the regional integration of the ASEAN. And it is not against this process that the region, these countries in themselves are already following. And I think that this process could really help them setting the standards, because if we have one model for the different countries, this could really help this country to have harmonized legislation, harmonized standards that could really help also within the region to have a single market or at least an homogeneous market in terms of legislation. On your specific question, I think that in the next weeks and months, we will have a great debate on how, as the European Union, we can be credible in following the idea of having a very strong trade policy, because it's absolutely necessary to change, in my view, at least the institutional architecture in some way on one side, and on the other side it's absolutely crucial to have much more involvement of the society in general, especially starting from the companies, the business, because what I am noticing going around Europe talking about international trade is that beside the biggest FTAs, the TTIP and now the CETA, is very difficult that companies and strategic consultancies are aware of what the European institutions are doing in trade policy. And for example, on Vietnam, it's very rare to know to meet someone that knows exactly what is inside, which are the opportunities, and how they can contribute in the implementation of the agreement.
I'm going to come to Peter in a second, but I want to take up José Antonio with you, just what Alicia said, that having an FTA with the EU could actually be a locomotive, a spur for regional integration, trade integration within ASEAN, further trade integration.
Yes, I will confirm that. I think on the whole, the ASEAN has been open to pursuing a regional FTA with the EU. But of course, we respect certain sensitivities and priorities of the EU. Now, last year in Chiang Mai, the ASEAN economic ministers and the trade commissioner met, and they agreed to outline a certain work program. I think Peter will talk about this more. And this was leading to a stock take in March next year. Also, Peter will, I hope, will be able to.
You've got your agenda also.
And, you know, the thing is, if there is enough basis to resume, we are prepared to resume. And in the meantime, we will also pursue very strongly and vigorously our individual FTAs. We have one with the EU, and our schedules are coming close, and I hope Peter will also talk about that later.
So we're going to get Peter to talk. Peter, we can talk as much as we like, but you're the one who does it, right? You're the one who actually goes and negotiates and opens the drawers and, you know, brings out the files and talks about tariffs, etc. So where are things at? Where are we at? What's happening with all the different countries we've talked about and the ASEAN agreement? Peter will talk about this.
Okay, well, I can talk about this. Yes, the government view now. After the business view, the government view. Now, ASEAN is on our radar screen. It's, as you said, 10 years since the idea came about under Peter Mandelson at the time, when we switched from the Doha-only agenda to a also bilateral agenda launched in parallel negotiations with ASEAN, Korea, and India. Korea, as you know, the only agreement in Asia in force, the only FTA we have in Asia for 4 years now. India, I'm just back from India, we're trying to resume the negotiations, but it's not a given. And then ASEAN. We reconfirmed our commitment to the ASEAN FTA in our Trade for All communication from last year, of course. It's quite dear to the commissioner to tap into this market. But we tried. We tried for 2 years between 2007 and 2009 to negotiate with the region. Our mandate allows us to not only negotiate with the 10, but also go to a smaller crowd, which we tried. Nevertheless, Laos, Cambodia always showed up, although they get everything but arms. And Burma was never invited at the time, but also showed up. But two years into that process, we realized, despite a preparatory work called the High Level, the Vision Group, which was then put by the ASEANs on the bookshelf, claiming that was an academic exercise, but it was some kind of a scoping paper, which we usually deal with FTA, future FTA partners. Despite all that preparatory work, we had such a divergent level of ambition inside ASEAN, but also between the EU and ASEAN, that we decided to suspend, take a tactical pause. We on our side then decided in 2007 to go bilateral. Not giving up the ultimate goal of a region-to-region agreement, but develop some building blocks in form of bilateral FTAs. We have launched and concluded negotiations with Vietnam and Singapore, hope that they are in force beginning of 2018. With Singapore, we have to upgrade the investment chapter to reflect new realities and wait for the European Court of Justice ruling on the division of competences on investment. Vietnam, we are at the moment legally scrubbing and then translating the text. Malaysia and Thailand, we have launched as well. Thailand, we have suspended 3 years ago for political reasons. We're not engaging with the military regime like that for the moment. And with Malaysia, 3 years ago, we pulled the plug because, again, there, the level of ambitions between us were not conducive to continue these negotiations. This year, we have launched Philippines and Indonesia and hope that in the next coming weeks to have the second round of these negotiations with Indonesia and the Philippines. Judging from a fast negotiations like we had with Vietnam, 3 years, these agreements will not be enforced tomorrow. It will take some time, but we have good precedents in the forms of Singapore and Vietnam, and we of course tell our friends that both agreements are quite ambitious and certainly create some kind of benchmark reference FTA, which should also be then the level of ambition we expect from other ASEAN FTA partners. So that's where we stand at the moment. We talked about the ASEAN-EU FTA just now, and ASEAN already has a number of regional FTAs. It has one with China, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, India. I don't know how much integration that brought, these FTAs have brought within the ASEAN group. So I don't know how much we can add to that as well, but certainly we think that with our level of ambition, which is far beyond these what we call shallow FTAs, we can contribute much more. But that brings us then to looking what's going on in ASEAN. We have the big announcement exactly a year ago, of the ASEAN Economic Community by the ASEANs themselves, more vision than reality for the moment. So it's a work plan which has a blueprint 2025 that indicates already by when further integration should be completed. But we have to constantly analyze, that's what we're doing at the moment, whether we see synergies here. The level of ambition between the ASEAN Economic Community, the RCEP negotiations, the other regional negotiations ASEAN has undertaken, do they match the level of ambition we want to see? And what are some members doing in TPP? Brunei, Malaysia, Singapore and Vietnam have been part of TPP and have made some quite good commitments that could also be transposed into future obligations and commitments when it comes to the EU FTA. So it's been, on the trade side, a tricky year after Brexit, CETA and Trump. And we have more. That's already enough. No, of course, that requires some kind of reflection on our side. Where do we go with our trade policy, our investment policy? What will be the effect of Trump's trade policy? Will there be a vacuum which we should fill, perhaps? Should the US pull out of ASEAN? What is China doing? China, I see more and more as a driving force behind RCEP rather than ASEAN, dictating the agenda, but also in light of its OBOR initiative, One Belt, One Road. Then we have also China's bilateral agreements in addition to the RCEP. We have the United States. What will they do now after TTIP most likely will fail in Congress? For us, the next steps is certainly remain engaged with ASEAN. The senior economic officials will meet again beginning of the year to prepare a ministerial meeting, the annual ministerial meeting, which, and Chiang Mai was this year, Jose, it's not last year, when the commissioner encouraged ASEAN member states ministers to continue with us the stocktaking with a view to resume ASEAN-EU FTA negotiations. That stocktaking is ongoing. We have analyzed the depths of ASEAN integration. We have analyzed the ambitions of our most comprehensive and ambitious respective FTAs. The next meeting will focus on distilling all that information and see whether there's added value in a EU-ASEAN FTA.
So that's not a given yet?
I think we have an economic case. Do we have a feasibility? Big question mark. And do we have the political framework? Is there an EU-ASEAN political framework as well to accompany such economic partnering?
The strategic partnership question. Just take a look outside. Demonstration. I'm not sure what it's about. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's anti-globalization, anti-trade, perhaps market economy status. So when you say if the political situation is ripe, I think this is also going to be quite an important part of it. just wanted to come to you, Gunther. We've talked a lot about the business side of things and, you know, the upbeat picture, the optimistic picture of a growing middle class, of a growing economy, of business opportunities opening up online and otherwise. But in the region, there are also challenges. We talked about some of them. But there's also, you know, corruption, not just in ASEAN, of course, worldwide, but it comes up in your business sentiment survey. And also there are allegations, there are human rights issues as well in many, many countries. And, you know, ASEAN civil society is a powerful force in demanding ASEAN become more active on human rights issues as well. So your thoughts.
Shada, thank you for giving me probably the most difficult subject to talk about, because it's a subject we normally don't want to talk about. But putting it in the right context with looking at FTAs and looking at human rights violations, looking at graft and corruption, I think with being more global and globalizing things, it also helps curb corruption and keeps it in the right perspective. While I think Asia is more prone to it than Europe, for whatever reason, let's not analyze that. What we do in the Philippines, and I, since I lived there for 30 years, I want to use that as an example. As the European Chamber of Commerce, we started a so-called Integrity Initiative, which is a pledge that we ask all our 780 members to sign, which clearly spells out and is very non-negotiable what are ethical ways of doing business and what are not. We have managed in the last 4 years to have about 7,000 signatures on it. We include the government as well. We go to all government agencies, and everybody signs it. We know that it's not a perfect way to curb corruption, but it's a good start. And if we then take best practices that we know from our multinational corporations that we all work with, if we then bring that into the equation, it certainly starts changing the picture. And if you look at it objectively, for me, working for a multinational company in the Philippines, what we try to do is level the playing field. We don't want to, as the good old saying goes, we don't want to step down to their level, but we want them bring them up to our level. And I think it's a good way of basically integrating these things in an FTA, and I think the FTA will help to curb those issues. If you mention, or since you mentioned human rights violations, it's a touchy subject, I guess. Again, not being political, but just objectively, I think it should, from my background being European, I think we all have a right to live. It's a very basic right, and I don't think anyone has the right to take that away from us. So I still think it does make sense to tie that in with any agreement, bilateral, multilateral, to say, fine, we do not want to do business with countries, with governments that do violate those basic rights. Yeah? Again, that is debatable at best, I think, but I think it helps to bring that down to the point wherein people just simply have to respect that. Mm.
And in any case, ASEAN has put human rights very definitely on its own agenda. Vision 2025 talks about civil society and responsibility, so that's important to bring up. I'm going to ask all of you to start thinking, and probably you already have questions to ask. I'm just going to ask Carsten one more question, and then I'm going to turn the floor to you, your comments and your questions for our panelists. Carsten, you wanted to come in, but I do have a question for you, and I'm going to sort of take the bull by the horns and talk about Brexit. There seems to be an assumption in London, and before and even now, that somehow everyone's going to be queuing up to do deals with this agile, nimble, free-trading Britain. In India, I mean, I was there as well, not with Peter, but separately, but I was in India as well, and it was during Theresa May's visit, you know, and frankly, they couldn't care less. It really wasn't high on their Indian agenda. That's very clear. I don't know, Carsten, what about ASEAN?
I think for us it doesn't change that much from a business point of view. We have trade lanes, you know, we're connecting 221 countries in the world. Last one, actually, we moved in was Turkmenistan, where we allowed not to provide services. I haven't heard a lot about bilateral negotiations so far on the ground, and I think it's much too early because we don't know what kind of Brexit will happen, soft, hard. So, I mean, I refuse to even go to events right now where consultants try to explain you what Brexit is about. I mean, I don't think that anybody knows yet where it's going to head. So I would be very cautious to jump to conclusions there. So for us, being a company which facilitates trade, I mean, we recently did a big investment actually in the UK. We bought the second largest parcel service provider for £230 million, I think. So we believe also in the UK as a market, in the contacts with ASEAN or other trading partners. I mean, it will be obviously a very tough project for them. I mean, they need to start from zero in the WTO, and that's going to be a lot of fun. But it doesn't change as long as there's demand from industry for trade or for people, consumers. If some people want to have UK products, there will be trade. So for us, it doesn't change a lot. Which brings us back to, if we set the same standards for trade and trade facilitation, then there will be prosperity in all regions. I just wanted to add on Günther, because corruption is a big issue, not only in Asia, of course, or in ASEAN. But, I mean, one very low-hanging fruit to cut back on corruption is actually customs reform, which is one part of a trade facilitation agreement. So if you move customs clearance from paper-based to electronic, if you introduce national single windows, you increase the transparency. And I think that's one of the issues. I mean, Philippines is a very good example. They have a new Customs Modernization and Tariffs Act into place. They're implementing it now. Once it's implemented, it will be the most modern customs law in the entire region. So it sets standards probably even beyond Singapore. And for a country like the Philippines, I think it's a huge gap, a huge step forward, not a gap. And it shows that many members of the ASEAN community now, they're looking at each other. I mean, it was Vietnam first, they reformed customs law last year. Philippines follows with a very modern customs law. And I think that's the right way to show to business that you can trade in a very good way and reliable way.
Constructive competition. Would anyone like to come in on this issue before I take questions from the floor? No? Okay. So we have Victoria with her microphone. Please put your hand up and introduce yourselves and go ahead. I can keep asking questions, but I think we have such expertise here. Jacques Peltman, for one. Jacques, where are you? You can't hide. You were part of the vision group. I don't know how many vision groups you've been part of. Okay, but please,
I co-chaired the preparation of the EU-Indonesia Free Trade Area, the high-level group with De Gucht and Pangestu. I did not work in the vision group, and I wouldn't have wanted to work in the vision group if the mandate was too weak. Right. But that report, which is public in two languages, in Bahasa and in English, I think is excellent if you want basis. It's basically the full scoping, and I'm very pleased that Indonesians and the EU are now, and the Philippines, but that's another story. But I want to listen to others.
Right, absolutely. Do I have any questions from the floor? Okay, so this is a mandate for me to go on, but I do see Carsten and I do see questions coming up here. So Victoria, please, could you put your hand up?
Yes.
Because I do want to ask you about the air transport agreement as well.
Thank you. Till Kopfer from British Telecom, but I also chair the policy committee of the European Services Forum, and hence a question on services. I mean, how strong do you see, because in many FTAs, the EU is the demander in services, and I wonder how you see the thirst at the Asian side to tackle also services in FTAs.
Would you like to take the floor, Peter? Services, Alicia? Yes.
Let's put it that way. We have very good results in Vietnam now and in Singapore, of course. It's an area which, on the other hand, in terms of ASEAN integration, could deserve much more attention. When you look at the AEC, RCEP, and the bilateral FTAs ASEAN has concluded, the services sector is, compared to the goods sector, quite underdeveloped. It reflects also that the ASEAN economic community is focusing on goods and has to catch up on services, not to mention procurement or investment, where markets are pretty closed still in between ASEAN member states. So there's some potential we want to exploit, of course, in our FTA negotiations. But it also when I came to the stock taking, we also thinking of the added value in areas like, for example, can we talk with ASEAN on corruption, which we mentioned earlier? Can we talk to them about energy and raw materials or e-commerce? When we tried this with ASEANs, often we were told, listen, we haven't even discussed that internally amongst us 10. How can we? You expect us to negotiate with the EU in a free trade agreement in areas like that? So there's still some catching up to be done. That's why we have to talk here about Asian timeframes rather than politicians' timeframes in Europe.
Right. To Alicia, would you like to come in on this unexplored? And Carsten, do you find this to be an impediment in, DHL?
Yes. Right, but also, as I said, the time is ripe now for change. I think almost all ASEAN member countries, as I'm aware, they're drafting e-commerce laws, for example. And so does China, by the way. And they will set the scene. So I think they have moved on because, as I said, what's happening is another revolution. You have a growing middle class and they all shop online. And they don't use PCs anymore. They just shop from a smartphone directly. They have Uber kind of services.
Are they buying from Alibaba?
They're buying from Amazon, from Alibaba, from Lazada, I mean, you name it. And as I said before, you can be a small retailer, bricks and mortar, and you go online, become a trader, and you trade with 10 countries or 20 or 30. And that's all there. The technology is enabling this enormous change of the industry. And therefore, we need to have, of course, services finding the right regulatory environment. And that goes also to market access restrictions, FDI, licensing, but this is all happening now. That's why I think the time is ripe also for the FTAs, because this can be now discussed, and I think your counterparts will have better ideas than they had maybe two or three or four years ago.
Right.
Let's be optimistic.
Anyone else on the panel want to come in on this? No. Okay, there was a gentleman over there. Yes, please. Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you.
Fine.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I'll give it to you.
Rory McRae, partner at G+ Europe Consultancy, not a Brexit one, I hasten to add. It's nice to hear so much optimism in the region, particularly under current circumstances. And I just wonder, in terms of the FTAs that are coming that have been agreed, if we're quite so confident that these are going to get through. And we've seen people walking past. We've had the CETA near-death experience. The two agreements that have been passed, or sorry, that have been agreed, have investment. And do we think that will get past the Parliament? Mm. We know the court's coming out, the ECJ has a Singapore case. Regardless of that, is this something that we think that national governments will be prepared to approve? And in that case, is it worth putting investment to them? Is it worth keeping these deals whole? Now, I think I have an idea of what the Commission at least will say, Peter, but I wonder what the Parliament has to say, and I wonder if for business it's really worth it to wait for the perfect agreement instead of actually pushing agreements through that will make a difference. Mm,
thank you, Rory. Please. Yeah.
This is the real crucial question for the Parliament. first of all, if you... have posed me this question 2 months ago, I would have answered yes, of course, for Vietnam, no problem. Now the situation changed, actually, because trade became the real hot topic on every single agreement on which we are talking about. It's true that Vietnam and Singapore, as I mentioned before, are not as debated. And we receive much less pressure from the public opinion, so to say, than other agreements that are debated everywhere and on which powerful movement around Europe have been created. So I can't answer for sure that we won't have any problem. What I can tell you is that so far the discussion on Vietnam, especially on Vietnam, have been very pragmatic, very relaxed within the Parliament, without such huge pressure as in the other agreement that we discussed in the past months. And actually, I have to say that Vietnam has been considered so far generally a good agreement, a model for the region, a very huge step forward in setting some standards that have been unthinkable before the conclusion of the agreement. Including the introduction of the new version of the investment protection that was not at all something that was considered at the beginning and neither almost at the conclusion of the agreement, that because you know that the inclusion of the chapter of the new ICS happened just at the very last moment of the talks. So I have to say so far that I am much more optimistic on the Vietnam agreement. We had also a discussion on human rights. The parliament expressed its concern about human rights in Vietnam. We presented an oral written question to the commission and we asked for reassurances on that. But also on that issue, the discussion was very strong, but not controversial in some way, and not at the level of undermining the approval or the ratification of the agreement. So it's difficult for me to make other statements concerning what is going to happen in, from here in 2 months, because we don't know what, which will be the atmosphere, the political atmosphere, but I am still optimistic to have a ratification of the agreement in 3 months.
Right. Does anyone want to quickly come in on this, Gunther?
I think quickly, from a business point of view, I don't think there is such a thing as a perfect agreement. But to me, even if it's not perfect, it's a good start to set certain criteria to move forward. And as I said, there's no such thing as a right agreement. It can always be pushed further and further and further. But if you don't get started, you'll never get to the finishing point. So point is, I think, even if it's not a perfect agreement, go ahead and do it. At least it gets the ball rolling.
Right. Thank you very much. The lady in front here, please.
Thank you. Gail Dussepulcre from FIDH, International Federation for Human Rights. So probably things have changed now with the opposition to the CETA and the TTIP, but at least we cannot say that the EU agreement with Vietnam has encountered no opposition from civil society. And I'm really surprised to hear that finally this agreement is fine, as you perfectly know that there has been a procedure before the EU ombudsman which said that the conclusion were not in line with the EU treaty. We have a problem regarding human rights and the EU FTA with Vietnam. And this problem is really simple. We have now the human rights dialogue with Vietnam this month also. This dialogue is there for 10 years also. But what we can see, it is that human rights defenders, bloggers and civil society who are trying to document the environmental disaster of Formosa in the steel sector, for example, are repressed and arrested. And you have absolutely nothing in the FTA to deal with the situation, even if it would have been...
Thank you very much for the question. But I think my, you my want question a response,
is,
right?
Yes, okay. But my question is not finished. So in the EU FTA, there is absolutely nothing to deal with that problem. And I would like to know, finally, how you will improve this situation to really deal with the impact of the EU FTA in Vietnam. So right. Not to deal with the human rights problem in Vietnam, in death penalty and so on. That's not the problem. Huh? It is the impact of the trade relations.
Okay, thank you very much. Alyssa, do you want to
yes.
take that?
Yes. As I mentioned before, we presented this written written question to the Commission because we wanted to push the question to the Commission. As a first answer, I have to say that in general, I think that we cannot think that trade could solve all the problems that we have because a trade policy could really be one tool, but we cannot think that trade policy is the only tool through which we can save all the problems. I am one of the members of the parliament pushing to have new generation agreements where there's also a high level of standards on human rights, on environmental rights, on social rights, and we are pushing to have this agreement with a very strong way of intervening in the countries with whom we are having agreements. So I think this is the direction we have to follow. But in the same time, we have to use the agreement to push the country, but without thinking that an FTA alone could be the right answer to deal with all these issues.
So, I mean, we can foresee major issues coming up with
the ASEAN.
At least we have a tool.
It's better to have it than not having it. Because at least with an FTA, we can put pressure on them. Without having anything, we don't have any tool.
Right. Thank you. Peter, do you want to come in quickly?
On that, because we are in touch on that question, of course, with FIDH. And it was raised by the Ombudsman and by questions from the European Parliament. But just to emphasize that we are just not in the Commission launching negotiation after negotiation. We do careful analysis of the impact on economic, social, human rights, environment before we ask for the mandate. Such an impact assessment has to accompany the request for negotiating directives. And before the end of the actual negotiations, we have to have a sustainability impact assessment to guide the chief negotiator in these negotiations. So there is a mechanism in place. In Vietnam, it was not perfect, granted. We have explained that to the Ombudsman. But that, for example, will be the process also which will be applicable for resumption of any EU-ASEAN FTA negotiations.
Okay, thank you very much. Gentleman over there, and then I'll come to you, Professor. Just put up your hand again, please. Yeah, thank you.
Martin Russell from the European Parliament Research Service. Could the panel say a bit about the implications of the new Philippine president for EU-ASEAN and EU-Philippine relations, trade and other aspects? Thank you.
José Antonio.
Well, at the outset I already said that as far as the ASEAN 2017 agenda is concerned, it's engaging our partners and engaging the world. So, it's hard for me to speak about my president. Probably it's not a good place to start talking about this. All I can say is that we in the service have not received any policy instruction that changes anything. So, we have a free country. He can say what he wants. He's the president. But so long as I don't have any instruction on any economic matter that changes the situation from what it was 4 months ago, then for me, it's business as usual.
And just José Antonio, any kind of let's say irritation that he, Duterte president, has with the EU will not have a fallout on ASEAN in any case, or will it?
Well, let me try to, because I think you're putting Jose on the spot here, because after all, he works for the government. But by and large, to answer your question, it is what you hear and what you see is probably just the rhetoric of one person. It does not reflect the mind and the mindset of 110 million Filipinos, rest assured. From the chamber work that we do, We work with all the cabinet secretaries of President Duterte, and we have had worked out a 10-point agenda, and all the cabinet secretaries are aligned with us on the business sector, so there's no issue there. I think we should overlook the rhetoric a little bit and really go down to the working level and understand where are we heading, what are the policies that we are trying to work out together with government, and there I can tell you, rest assured, we are a little bit behind in terms of time frame, but governments do work slow, but by and large we are on the right track in terms of economy. And I think we shouldn't get to the level wherein we take those things personal. I think life goes on. We do our jobs. It sounds a little bit, and I always say, if you look from the outside in, it looks different than if you look from the inside out. For me, living there for 30 years, as I said, life goes on as normal. There hasn't been any impact on our working with the Philippine government and getting things on track and work there.
Okay, I just received a text message from the president. No, I'm just quoting from my notes. This is the 10-point agenda of Mr. Duterte. I will not mention all 10, just the first four. The first is continue and maintain current macroeconomic policies, including fiscal, monetary, and trade policies. Second is the tax reform. We need to continue doing that. The third is increase competitiveness and the ease of doing business. Incidentally, we went up another 10 percentage, 10 ranks position in the World Bank's ease of doing business. And the fourth one is accelerate annual infrastructure spending up to 5% of GDP, because right now we're doing only about 2%. So we will push it up to 5%. I think that's about it.
Okay, thank you very much. So possibly, if I may say, it could be a good omen for what we have to deal with President Donald Trump when he takes over. Okay, Professor.
Gerhard Stahl, College of Europe, Peking University, HSBC Business School. My question concerns OBOR and the relationship to the ongoing FTA negotiations. I just came back last week from a big conference about standardization, which took place in Xi'an and which was under the title OBOR. That means one could see that behind this initiative, there's also an initiative to develop regulatory competences and also to be able to propose ideas based on Chinese priorities. Do you see that these initiatives with OBOR are in contradiction to efforts in the FTA agreements to set certain standards and rules? Or do you see that this might be even an element of synergy, because in this type of conferences you have also European experts, so there is an exchange of view. So how do you see this regulatory competition between OBOR and our understanding of FTA agreements?
Thank you very much, Gerhard. Would anyone who would like to come back? Yes, Gus?
I'll try to give you an answer from the business point of view. Everything in the past 2-3 years in China has been labeled One Belt, One Road. So OBOR is everything and everywhere, and it's Mr. Xi Jinping, or President Xi Jinping's kind of baby personal thing. But of course, there's more behind, you're right. It will set certain standard, but a lot of the investment goes into infrastructure first. So it's not the regulatory environment yet. It's not like a free trade agreement. So it sets probably different measures and standards. And when we talk to MOFCOM or other parts, so Asia Infrastructure Investment or Development Banks, also like from our point of view, what is important is if the Chinese put in money to build road or bridges, or when it comes to cross border contacts, they should actually put in the contracts also that there should be trade facilitation, because it's a sunk investment if you bulldozer factories or a road in a part of anywhere in ASEAN or other countries. We're talking also about Pakistan, and you don't have really any possibility to ship the goods then across the border, or the truck is stuck for 48 hours because the border or the trade facilitation infrastructure hasn't been really thought through. So One Belt, One Road can be very helpful. It can help to
increase prosperity and trade also within ASEAN, but also the other countries. In my company, for example, we're doing One Belt, One Road since more than 3 years. We actually ship on a rail connection from China, 10 different starting points in China through Russia, the stands into Europe, and we're actually looking also into the southern, the Silk Route now, which is via Iran and Turkey, for example. So it can bring a lot of benefits, but I think they should also look at the trade facilitation part when they set these kind of standards.
And for any one of you, actually, the Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank that China has set up and where the EU, not the EU, but EU member states are members, how is that connecting with the ASEAN Connectivity Master Plan? I mean, is that project moving forward within ASEAN thanks to the AIIB?
I would not know. I couldn't answer you that question, but I do not see anything of that sort in Manila.
I think in general there is not a lot of tangible results yet. I mean, I was in Singapore at a World Bank conference 1 month ago, I think, and we discussed these issues. And I was on the panel One Belt, One Road, and I asked the colleagues from AIIB, actually, so what are the next tangible projects? Where do you build as a bridge, or what is going to happen? So he couldn't answer the question either. So as I said again, this is a very much typical Chinese government-driven program. There's a lot of money behind, but the tangible results, you start seeing they're building some factories or power plant in some of the countries, but I think the plan is still not really materializing as a real plan.
Right. Okay. So more questions from the floor. So, Peter, I did want to ask you about Qatar. So this is the Comprehensive Air Transport Agreement. Do you think the way forward, and would any of you agree, is to do these smaller deals rather than embark? Would that satisfy your hunger for market opening, new vistas opening up in terms of businesses?
Thanks, Shada. So, for example, the tariff-only FTA with ASEAN, well, that's is not our mandate. You know, our mandate is an ambitious and deep and comprehensive FTA encompassing goods, services, investment, procurement, and other rules, plus a huge chapter on sustainable development. So we had these discussions in every FTA with CETA or with TTIP, especially at the beginning. But our mandate, which we were given and endorsed again by the member states, is to go for a deep and comprehensive, and that means a single undertaking.
Right. And what about these smaller agreements that have been concluded, for instance, on air transport? Well, they're not smaller, but they're service-based agreements. Is that the way forward as well?
Well, it's a starting point for further engagement with ASEAN. I think it's the first ASEAN-EU negotiation for in a formal agreement, this time on air transport. We hope that many will follow. An FTA is an example of another such type of agreement. And we hope that many more will come, that the current relationship moves more from a dialogue also up to a higher level to more structured agreements in other areas.
Right. Lisa, do you want to come in?
I see this sectorial agreement sort of a preparation of something bigger and more ambitious. So sectorial agreements are really welcome because they start to open the relation and they get used, the counterparts to relate one with the other, and they start to set the standards on some issues. I would like to underline one element on that. I think that we have not to see, or we have not to, or we have to change a little bit our way of looking at FTAs and this agreement. I don't see here only this willingness of having free trade or reduced barriers, because we know that especially the tariff barriers are already, not always, but are already quite low. The real rationale underneath all this agreement is really to set standards, because the next step and the real step forward is to set new standards that could really help not only the business community, but in general the broader community to have relations and to live in a world where especially our standards in some fields where we reached very high standards can be developed also somewhere else.
Carson, would that meet the bill as far as business is concerned?
Well, I can only comment on the cargo side, not on the passenger side, if it comes to Qatar, for example. But I think it's a very good mandate. It's probably a bit short with 2 years from the member states, as we know the complexity of these agreements. But I mean, we have negotiated 2 open sky agreements with the US in the past years, and we have, you know, we're working on our European single sky for quite a long time. But if you just think at the environmental benefits, the increase of safety, and of course reduction of costs, I mean, I think it would be certainly, from what I know about the mandate, I haven't seen the documents, I think they're confidential. But what I've heard is basically, I think, from the cargo side, very beneficial. It would really help to set standards for trade, air transport in particular, which would be very good for both for the region and also for European industry.
Right. And do you want to comment on that? No. The one thing that also, Donald, your business sentiment survey talks about, it says that 52% of respondents say that trade barriers are hampering supply chain efficiency in the region, and 44% report facing unfair competition from local and regional incumbents, including state-owned and government-linked enterprises. Would you like to comment on that?
Don't want to monopolize the... Well, I think it depends probably from which sector these replies are coming. I mean, we've been in this region, I said, 43 years. DHL is quite well established. Of course, there are problems with market access from time to time, but you know, we are in all the countries present, and we can basically trade. I don't say it's easy, and that's why we're discussing this. So the free trade agreement should make things easier, should provide, of course, for fair treatment of all players in the market. So there's a lot to do, as I said before, but I think, again, I would focus on the low-hanging fruits. So implementing swiftly the trade facilitation agreement from Bali 2013, that would be one of the low-hanging fruits. Looking into customs reforms, purely from a supply chain service provider, these are issues I would tackle first.
I think if you go a little bit deeper in this survey and try to find out, it sort of matches up with the question you asked me earlier with graft and corruption. Because for multinational companies, we play by the rules, meaning we have very high ethical standards. We do not bribe anyone. We do not attempt to do anything that is not legal. Again, if you then look at local companies... I'm talking now in the Philippines, for instance, but also we have the same issues in our Thailand office, in our Vietnam office, in our Myanmar office. If you then compete against local companies, that changes completely, because then that component is still very, very rampantly there, and it doesn't level the playing field. So you compete against someone that you know from the very beginning you cannot win. And I think that's one of the aspects we have to seriously look at. And again, I think to reiterate what I said earlier, FTAs will help to level the playing field, because you really weed out a lot of those things. And of course, to get rid of graft and corruption will take time. You know, it's not something that will happen overnight. But again, like earlier what I said, if you don't start today, you'll never get to the finishing line.
I have a question from Annette, lady over there. Please just introduce yourself.
I'm Annette Balawing from the Philippines. I'm sorry to go back to the human rights issue, but a month ago, the chairperson of the Commission of Human Rights in the Philippines came up with a front page warning that the extrajudicial killings that are currently happening in the Philippines, it's now more than 4,000, I've lost count, is going to have some economic impact, and he made it specifically. He specifically said that it's going to impact the EU-Philippine FTA negotiations. I think the problem is that any criticisms on human rights is personalized by the president. I think this is the issue that, you know, any critique that he will get on a human rights issue, he will take it as a personal attack on him, I think. He actually told the EU to go to the purgatory because he told the Americans to go to hell.
Right.
So at least the purgatory gives the EU a bit more hope that it's not so hopeless. But, you know, I think there is that statement of the Commission on Human Rights, the chairperson of the Commission on Human Rights demonstrates that there is actually an expectation for some foreign support to the current domestic opposition, right, to this human rights issue. So the question is, there is a chapter on human rights in the EU-Philippine FTA, so how is that going to play, right, given the records of human rights in the Philippines now?
Thank you very much, Annette. I think this is, Gunter, do you want to take the question? I think it's going to be an ongoing challenge for the EU as it negotiates different agreements with ASEAN countries.
I don't want to preempt Peter's job here, but again, speaking of human rights violations, my point here has always been from the very beginning, because the question is asked five times over every day since it started. The question you have to answer first, who actually kills who? And I don't think at this point in time anyone can point at one particular person. I've been working with the Human Rights Commission in Manila with attorney Gwen Gana very closely there. Currently, I think 91 cases that have been brought before the commission for investigation. I haven't seen any result because they haven't concluded anything. So I think before we point the finger on who does what, we've got to find out first. Yeah? And I am sure at one point in time, again, not to preempt what Peter is going to say, somebody will raise the question and it will have an impact.
Right. Thank you. Peter?
Sure. By coincidence, I'm the chief negotiator for the FTA with the Philippines. And we had a good start before the summer break. We were very happy that we launched these negotiations and we will continue to conduct them. We have, of course, heard also President Duterte, and I asked Jose Ramon, shall I still feel welcome when I come to Manila for the next round? And he reassured me that I will get nice treatment. But the round might be moved to Cebu or to Davao or whatever. But before that, we have another set of colleagues going to Manila, and these are the colleagues in charge of monitoring the implementation by the Philippines of its commitments under GSP+. The Philippines have been granted GSP+ trade preferences in return for living up to commitments it undertook in a number of conventions, environmental, labor, and human rights conventions. So these colleagues will go from the ES and from DG Trade and DG Employment to check surplus what is going on in the Philippines in terms of living up to these commitments, because that is a condition for trade preferences unilaterally granted to the Philippines. So this monitoring mission will come in the next couple of weeks and then followed up by our next round of FTA negotiations.
Right, so many tools in the toolbox, as it were. Jose Antonio, please.
Just to thank Peter for his reassurances. I will not talk about the human rights issue. I don't think I've been looking at the FTA draft. I can't find a chapter on human rights. Maybe the PCA, the Partnership Cooperation and Framework Agreement. Just to say that we are very much engaged with the EU, and that we look forward to hosting the second round of the FTA negotiations outside of Manila. And there's a very practical reason for that. Traffic. We have at least equaled the horrendous traffic situation in Bangkok. And the chief negotiator of the Philippines said, we better bring people together in a place outside Manila, keep them inside a hotel so that they are concentrated. Because if you allow them to go home to their homes every day, they will be using up 4 to 5 hours every day just commuting. So that's the practical reason. And then on GSP Plus, yes, we are clearly aware of the commitments on the 27 international conventions. And we are very much also aware of the other unwritten or unknown commitment, which is the willing to cooperate when the monitoring exercises are scheduled. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone in the panel like to come in? Okay, then it's my pleasure actually to wrap this up. I think we've had a very interesting, significant discussion because it shows how multifaceted this EU-ASEAN relationship is. So next year, when we do celebrate 40 years of EU-ASEAN, there will be a great deal to talk about, successes, but also weaknesses in this relationship. One of the things that is going to be important, and I think, Donald, you'll agree, will impact very much on the business community, is whether or not this relationship is brought to a strategic partnership. For the moment, that is not the case. And of course, the EU-ASEAN FTA, if discussions have started or are on the point of starting next year, that will also inject new energy into this discussion. But I think it's important to remember that ASEAN-EU relations is not just about trade and business. That is, I think, the backbone, but it's moving beyond. And José Antonio mentioned cities, urbanization, traffic congestion, pollution, environmental problems. And I think those are the kinds of areas that are being looked at by EU and ASEAN as part of the Bangkok Declaration. The EU foreign ministers met with their ASEAN counterparts. So as I said, multifaceted. And one of the things that I think is important that I have taken away from the business sentiment survey is that as China slows down, and we see that's happening, we will be looking for other centers of growth. And I think ASEAN, with its dynamic economy, regardless of all the problems we have, is one of those centers. It's important to say that in the survey, 74% of European businesses project a rise in their profits in ASEAN in 2016. Two-thirds plan to expand operations and employment in the region. And, of course, we come back to the FTA. 66% of them express an interest in acceleration of the FTA between the EU and ASEAN. So thank you very much indeed for your questions. Thank you to the EU-ASEAN Business Council for bringing their topic here and for cooperating with us in organizing this very stimulating discussion. Please join me in thanking the panelists.